Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. U.S. House members Scott Fitzgerald and Tom Tiffany vote to not accept Electoral College returns from two states. Senator Ron Johnson said he also planned to object to returns confirming the election of President-elect Joe Biden, but Johnson did not object. Wisconsin's COVID-19-related deaths hit 5,000 as the state assembly passes its first response to the pandemic since April. But Democratic Governor Tony Evers objects to parts of that bill. Rewind, your week in review for January 8.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
After 3 weeks of being gone for the holidays, we got a lot of news to cover, but let's start with the Thursday morning vote in Congress to ratify the Electoral College ballots showing President-elect Joe Biden won the election. Specifically, two of our U.S. House members from Wisconsin, first-term new representative Scott Fitzgerald, and 5th District and 7th District Republican Tom Tiffany voted to object to those Electoral College results. Also, let's talk about Ron Johnson, who had said he had planned to reject, but after the rioting in the Capitol, when the Capitol was cleared, the Senate resumed deliberations. Johnson did not object, and he told, I think, you, J.R., I'll give you a chance to talk about it in a moment. He said in an interview with you, "Rioters do not in any way, shape, or form remind me or look like or act like any Trump supporter I know." Now let's just, for the record, the members of Congress from Wisconsin who voted to uphold the Electoral College balloting and Mr. Biden's win, Senator Tammy Baldwin, Congressman Mark Pocan, Rep. Gwen Moore, Ron Kine, Brian Steele, Glenn Grothman, and Mike Gallagher, who was on both CNN and Fox calling it the rioting, something that occurs in the Banana Republic. Okay, JR, long opening. Your take on the votes by our members of Congress on the Electoral College.
Well, break them into kind of segments. First, let's look at Mike Gallagher. He was the only Republican member of the Wisconsin delegation who, ahead of the vote, publicly said he would not support what was going on. Now, some people point out that Gallagher signed into both a statement and a letter that left open the door that if state legislatures thought that their elections had not been run properly, could send in new electors and then raise an issue for Congress to decide. But absent that, he said, it's Congress's role to count the ballots, not to decide who won. Interesting that doing your constitutional duty, following what's in there from our founding fathers, is considered a principled stand in what the environment we're in right now, because you got to think for Mike Gallagher long term. He's mentioned as a possible candidate for U.S. Senate 2022 if Ron Johnson's run for election. Will this be an issue for him with the Republican base that he broke with President Trump on this high-profile issue? It's an interesting question to think about beyond what happened this week. Two, you had Tiffany and Fitzgerald who objected. Now, their explanations are that their constituents believe that there is something that amiss with how the election was run. They're a voice for their constituents. At the same time, they're also basically voting to overturn the election and who was the president. The question has to be raised, if it weren't for a Democratic-controlled House and Republicans in the Senate who said they would not do this, would you still see people like Fitzgerald and Tiffany voting the same way? Then go to Glenn Grothman, who may be the most honest person in what he did, said that he considered voting to uphold the objections of Arizona and Pennsylvania, but in the end thought that was too much, that the founding fathers were spinning in their graves at what he watched. He said in a statement that there are members of Congress from Arizona, I think Michigan and Pennsylvania, who told him privately that Biden won those states, but they won't say it publicly. I mean, he gave an honest answer that, you know, this was kind of a symbolic move, but in the end, how would Republicans feel if 4 years from now, the Republican nominee had 275 electoral votes, to paraphrase his statement, but Democrats said, no, we're going to reject Wisconsin's votes for that GOP nominee because of the voter ID law, or because there weren't, in their opinion, enough polling sites? How would Republicans feel? They'd be apoplectic. So it's right. An interesting just dynamic for those members of the House.
Right. And just a very quick footnote. Representative Louis Gohmert, who challenged, who was going to challenge, I think, four states, at one point said, I want to challenge the results in Wisconsin. But Vice President Pence said, is there a U.S. senator who also objects to the Wisconsin results? And there were none. So any PSs, JR, time to move on?
Congressman Gohmert also distorted what happened in Wisconsin. One, he said that no court had heard, allowed, in his words, no court had allowed an evidentiary hearing about allegations of fraud. That is not true. A federal court gave the Trump lawyers an opportunity, said, now, the Trump campaign lawyers passed up the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing in one of the federal cases. To be clear, the federal judge encouraged him, the lawyers for Donald Trump, to reach an agreement with the defense side on the facts to present in that case. They did that, but they had an opportunity, if they really wanted to push it, to present allegations of fraud in court, passed it up. Number two, Congressman Gohmert said that Milwaukee officials had created illegal 200 illegal polling sites. President Trump's lawsuit targeted Madison's Democracy in the Park, which had 200 poll workers at 200 city parks to collect absentee ballots. And finally, he said that tens of thousands of ballots had been appropriately changed by local election officials. Trump's lawsuit identified 5,500 ballots in Milwaukee and Dane counties that they said had local clerks filling missing information for the witnesses of those who voted absentee. So he wasn't quite all on point in the justification he raised for trying to object to Wisconsin electoral votes.
That's a very good point. Meanwhile, back in the state capitol, there was a lot of back and forth, but I want to get into it this way. Let's just point out that the new legislature was sworn in, but there was so much back and forth, and we're going to highlight just two speakers, Senator Gwen Moore and the Assembly Speaker Voss, on the issue of requiring masks in the capitol and opening up the capitol. So before we get into that, let's hear from Senator Moore and Speaker Voss.
Whether you like it or not, whether you agree or you don't, I am elected and sent and deserve to have a voice, and none of you have the right to deny that. I stand here in this body, even though some of you have no respect for my life, anyone in this body not wearing a mask does not care about the life of my father, who has the blood type that is the most susceptible. Anybody in this body should be concerned of all Wisconsinites. You have the right to choose, and I stand back and allow you to have that right to choose, but I have the right to tell you that I do not appreciate the disregard for life.
And we saw, in a very unprecedented way, that the executive branch ordered that the Capitol be closed. We knew right away that that was something that we had a chance to come back. We had to find a way to address. So under the joint powers that the laws of Wisconsin grant to not only the legislature, but also the executive branch, we have the ability to open the Capitol. And that is simply by a resolution that we would all adopt. That doesn't say that folks who come here to the Capitol should not wear a mask. I think they should. It does not say that people who come to the Capitol should not practice social distancing or use their own God-given ability to figure out what is wise for them and their family. But it does mean that they should have the opportunity to come into their Capitol to observe our committees, their government, and be able to have a redress of their grievances that is not done simply over Zoom.
First, a correction. I said we'd be hearing from Senator Gwen Moore. I apologize. That was obviously Senator Lena Taylor. I did cover Senator Gwen Moore when she was in the state Senate, but that you heard from Senator Lena Taylor. Okay, let's just quickly look at the new makeup of the 21-22 legislature. In the Senate, Republicans have a 20-12 majority, with the seat of former Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald to be filled April 6th. 8 of the 32 senators are serving their first term, although I think 5 of them had come over from the Assembly. 10 of 32 senators are women, 6 Democrats and 4 Republicans. And you have the first African-American Republican senator, Senator Julian Bradley. in the assembly. Republicans will have a 60-38 majority with an April 6th special election to fill the seat of that had been held by Representative John Nygren. And 19 of the 98 assembly members are serving their first term. 31 of the 98 assembly members are women, 10 Republicans and 21 Democrats. Any thoughts on the makeup of the new ledge before we move on, JR?
No, it'd be interesting to watch how the Republican caucuses interact going forward this session. You have a larger Republican caucus in the state Senate. The question kind of becomes how, you know, they can lose three members right now, so pass a bill. It also looks like a little more conservative caucus than it was before. So kind of watch how that, those two caucuses interact and what it means for getting big bills done, like the budget, and oh, by the way, like the COVID bill this week, there's a little bit of disagreement about whether that bill's in agreement or not.
Right. Okay. And before we get into that back and forth on the COVID bill, let's set the stage on COVID. The latest numbers from the Department of Health Services, 498,538 positives since early March. And the death toll, tragically, now is 5,079. Those are the numbers of as of yesterday. New numbers coming up on 2 p.m. But I'm intrigued. This is what Governor Evers said. Look, I understand that everybody wants to be vaccinated, but I don't expect to get vaccinated until, listen to when he says, Bill, before we get into the back and forth, let's listen to Governor Evers saying, continue to wear masks, social distance, etc. Please.
People still have to wear a mask. People still have to keep socially distanced. We have to do all those things. All this interest in the vaccinations, I get it. But at the end of the day, if we let our guard down because of, you know, the expectation that we're going to get a shot tomorrow and life is going to be good, we will be making a horrible, horrible mistake, because it is going to take us a long time to get these vaccines in people's arms. I don't expect to get vaccinated until this summer. It's all going to take time. People have to be patient. But while they're being patient, they also have to continue doing the things that they have done that make sure that we aren't continuing to infect each other while we're waiting for a shot. That seems counterintuitive to me.
Our governor, a cancer survivor, doesn't even expect to be vaccinated until the summer. That's very interesting. But anyway, let's talk about what Health Services Secretary Palm said. Our COVID vaccinations are the most significant public health intervention in Wisconsin history. The state has been allocated 420,200 doses of vaccine for frontline health workers, nursing home residents. Vaccinations did slow over the holidays, but will ramp up now that more than 1,000 vaccinators are trained. Let's just talk about the vaccination numbers. On Tuesday at the DHS briefing, Secretary Palm said 85,000 had been vaccinated. Latest number, which you reported, JR, and I'm stealing from your reporting, is 110,201. So, what in 2 days, 25,000 more vaccinations. But JR, I know how controversial this is because Speaker Voss and other Republicans say we still lag. What's your take on our vaccination rollouts?
Well, if you look big picture for Governor Evers, this is a true test of his administration. Governor Evers had issues with his backlog for the employment program. There were issues with how he handled Kenosha and the violent protests back in August after the shooting of Jacob Blake. He cannot afford to have the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine go awry. So if you look at the numbers, and there are lots of ways to look at them, the Journal sent out a story this week about how we rate compared to other Midwestern states on a per capita basis. Bloomberg has a system for looking at how many vaccines have been given each state versus how many have been delivered. And depending on how you look at it, we're lagging behind some of our peers. This is at a tipping point right now. Unless we get things on track in Wisconsin, and there is a confidence in the way the system is working and how we're delivering the vaccine, it'll cause massive headaches for Governor Evers, especially if he seeks re-election in 2022. Now, I'm not saying all is lost. Like I say, it's at a tipping point where it could go either way. But if they can get a hold of this, it can be a real success story. And maybe one of the overriding themes going into 22, if they don't get a hold of it, it could really undermine his argument for re-election.
Okay, good point. But now let's get into the nitty-gritty back and forth on the Assembly's first COVID bill. They convened on Monday. The Assembly Health Committee had a public hearing on Tuesday on AB 1, 44 items in that package, And then they passed it on Thursday in the assembly. But let's just go back and forth on that. The assembly speaker Voss said, "Look, we had a package in December. It had many provisions the governor said he couldn't accept. So then we went back and scaled it back in some notable ways." And we passed a scaled back bill. We're hoping the governor would sign it. But then Senate Majority Leader said yesterday, our caucus doesn't support it. And the governor said, we had a deal on December 21st. That was a date he put out a press release saying, I believe we have a compromise on these 20 or 25 provisions. And he doesn't. So meanwhile, a Republican state senator, Stephen Nass, said, look, I want parents dealing with at-home learning to be reimbursed, and he is saying I'm not going to pass this. We're not going to vote for this in the Senate. So they have a lot of big disputes. GR, before we hear from both the governor and Voss, your take on the back and forth on the assembly passed bill.
Well, a couple of things. One, you've been covering this place for a long time, and that Senate Republican caucus, I don't remember last time a bill was unveiled on a Monday and they passed it by week's end and had agreement on it. That's not the way the Senate Republican caucus works. Usually that caucus has to have time to kind of, you know, let things simmer, find its kind of its balance, and then the leader can close the deal, which is what Scott Fitzgerald did very, very well for the 14, 15 years he was in charge of that caucus. 15. This is the first big test or first example of Devin LeMahieu working on a major piece of legislation with Robin Voss. Early signs aren't that great. Robin said they had that he was very confident the Senate would pass it. LeMahieu told reporters in statements that there's a reason that was an assembly bill, i.e. we're not on board. That seemed to raise questions about even if the bill got through the assembly, which it did on party line votes, if it would go anywhere, because the Senate wasn't on board, and oh, by the way, the governor would probably veto it unless there were major changes. You know, Robin tried to portray this as a compromise because he says he dropped things that he wanted, like reimbursing parents if their districts go virtual, but left in things the governor wanted, so that Tim's a compromise. The governor says his bill's a compromise, but it represents the things that people had agreed to already. Robin says that's not the case because the discussions are still ongoing. Bottom line is we don't have a bill that right now, as far as he is going to get done without some significant changes. The question is, going forward, how do they work together? Don't forget, this is just bill number one. We have a budget to pass this year. There are big things on the agenda. If you can't get this done, what's it mean for those other items coming down the pipe in the 21-22 session?
Yeah, and here are two things that Governor Evers does not like in the assembly passed bill. 14-day authority to close businesses, that authority given to local health officers. After that, local units of government would have to vote to continue those closings, point one. Point two, if your school district offers only online, that school district has to vote every 14 days to reaffirm that decision. Excuse me. Now let's hear from Governor Evers saying we had a deal, it was went back on, and Speaker Voss saying this is a reasonable package. Please.
We had a bill that had 20 to 25 major points that the Republican leadership had agreed to. And so why not get something done? And instead, they have decided that that bipartisan effort was not to their liking, which is an odd position to take. And so I haven't had a chance to look at the final bill, but if it involves some of the ones that I absolutely couldn't agree to, the likelihood of a veto is probably pretty strong.
This is a good bill. It's a good bill that resulted in lots of discussions. It started out with Governor Evers, myself, and the Senate Majority Leader. Unfortunately, then Governor Evers walked away from the table thinking that he could just kind of dictate what the terms of the deal would be. I am very optimistic that everything in here is something that is modeled off of good ideas. It's modeled off past practice. And in many cases, it's modeled off of what other states with divided government have been able to accomplish. And I hope that we will be able to get a 90 unanimous vote today on this bill to show the state of Wisconsin we can work together. We have a good answer for COVID, and it's a great bill that allows people to visit their families, continues the unemployment help that we have provided, along with ensuring that we also have more accountability to taxpayers, families, and those who are paying the bills.
Another major development while Rewind was on holiday hiatus, the Department of Workforce Development said it had cleared a backlog. That backlog was 100,000 pending claims for unemployment insurance benefits as of September. But context, DWD had been swamped with 8.8 million claims for weekly jobless benefits since March, 1.66 million more than over a four-year period, 2016, 17, 18, and 19. When the backlog was cleared, the governor announced the secretary designee, Amy Pahacek, who had been running the department since the dismissal of Caleb Frostman. And well, here's my question, JR. Backlog cleared. Secretary designee Amy Pahacek, now she took over for Frostman. Will she be confirmed, do you think, by the state Senate?
Oh, excellent question. I mean, there has been significant progress on claims, weekly claims in progress from when she took over to now. They added this Google Cloud service to help resolve claims, things like that. But, you know, the Evers administration is the one claiming victory on the backlog. I'm not sure Republican lawmakers agree, because there are still people who have been waiting months for these various, you know, there are different strains of unemployment you can claim, you know, apply for. It's not like everybody who's been waiting for months all of a sudden got their check. There are still problem cases out there, and they're an issue for the governor. But she's made progress on this issue since taking over. I just don't know if that Senate Republican caucus is in an agreeable position right now to confirm any of Evers' cabinet picks that are left. Remember, this isn't the only one. There's a DATCAP right. Secretary who was appointed after Brad Paff was fired. Transportation Secretary has not been confirmed. Health Services Secretary, State Special Services Secretary.
Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, excuse me, yeah.
Yep, we also have Sarah Meany left tourism late last year. So there are vacancies. And with the history between Evers and Senate Republicans, I don't know that caucus is going to be in a big hurry to approve anybody anytime soon. Now, remember, They still serve in their jobs. They still get paid, even without confirmation. But the Republicans can hang that over their heads of, if you don't do what we like, we may take the step of removing you. So it's kind of an uncomfortable position to be in.
Right. Okay, and just a very, very quick programming footnote. I'm scheduled to interview Secretary Designee Pahacek next Wednesday. Okay, let's move on. This week, the Kenosha County DA, two-hour press conference. I could not get a jury, I believe, to convict the policeman who shot any of the police officers involved in the August shooting of Jacob Blake. But now let's focus on the response in the Capitol. First of all, let's quote Sheila Stubbs, who's the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus and co-chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Racial Disparities. Representative Stubbs, the Black Caucus will continue to demand justice for victims of police brutality and for reforms of our criminal justice system. The co-chair of the Speaker's Task Force, Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke, I'm working across the aisle to find solutions that will reduce these types of instances when possible and provide further clarity and transparency when not. I am hopeful that we'll meet our goal of creating meaningful change. The governor said, we must work each day in earnest toward a more just, more fair, and more equitable state and country, and to combat the racism experienced by Black Wisconsinites. I reaffirm my commitment to action to build a more just, more equitable state for every Wisconsinite. Finally, short quote from Attorney General Josh Call, there is a pressing need for reform for our criminal justice system. The system we have in place has produced staggering and unacceptable racial disparities. Here's my question. The Speaker's Task Force has met two or three times. The Speaker made it clear we want to focus on a COVID response package and election reform. Do you think the Speaker's Task Force will, it's a 32-member task force. What are the odds that they're going to come up with something fairly quickly? What do you think?
Well, it's to be determined. And it's not just about what they come up with something quickly. It's whether it's meaningful. Getting that many people to agree on something could be difficult. So the jury is still out on whether it's going to be a bill that actually does anything, or if it's just something that's, you know, a representative of the compromise or the consensus of this body, but isn't necessarily very aggressive because you can't get that many people to agree on something.
Okay, good point. Okay, I found it very significant. On Christmas Eve, a slow day in the Capitol, Chief Justice Patience Rogenczak issued this statement. All members of the public have a constitutional right to speak in criticism of public servants. However, no justice should be threatened or intimidated based on his or her religious beliefs. The statement followed social media criticism, attacks on three justices who had voted to dismiss President Trump's challenge to Democrat Joe Biden's win in Wisconsin. Response from a campaign advisor to Representatives Dalet, I'm sorry, Justices Dalet and Justice Karofsky. The volume and intensity of the feedback they're getting has hit a new level. It is more vile, more racist, more gendered, more threatening than what we have seen in the past. Just quickly, JR, your take, it happened Christmas Eve. It's not old news because it's very unusual for a Chief Justice to issue a statement like this. Just quickly.
It's a reflection of the times. I mean, think about how people talk to each other in politics all the time now. Look at how our leaders talk to each other right now. This is a sad state about where we are as a country. End of story.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to your stock picks. Rising.
So there wasn't much good news this week, to be honest with you. But one good thing, we found out that the Medicaid fund has a bigger surplus than we expected. Go back to September. They're talking about $289 million projected as a surplus through the end of June of this year. Now we're up around $618 million. There are a couple of things going on. One, the federal government is doing a higher reimbursement rate for Medicaid cases that they extended through the end of March. It's supposed to end in December. Two, while enrollment is growing, it's not growing as fast as they thought it might, so that's helping produce a surplus. A word of caution, the enrollment rate is supposed to keep growing even after the enhanced reimbursement rate ceases. So while there's a pot of money now, it's not going to be there when these cases keep going up in the next budget, but it's more money possibly to play with as the governor Evers introduces his budget in February.
February. Mixed.
Ron Kind. So, look, Ron Kind voted for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker after voting for two other people the last two leadership elections. Republicans are going to hang this around his neck in 2022. Newsflash, they're going to tie to Nancy Pelosi no matter what he did in this leadership election. But it's going to be interesting to watch Kind the next 2 years. You know, obviously, he hasn't said he's going to seek re-election in 22 yet, but what's his district going to look like? Will it get more Democratic? Will it get more Republican? President Trump won his district in both 16 and 18, but Kind won re-election in 18 with 60% of the vote. It raises the question, if Donald Trump's not on the ballot, do Donald Trump supporters come out? There's a prime example right there. And, oh, by the way, Derek Van Orden, who ran against Kind in 2020, had the closest margin with Kind of anybody since Kind won that seat in 1996. He's already making noise about running again in 2022. He was at the protests out in Washington, D.C. that turned violent this week. Now, he says he wasn't there when he didn't storm the Capitol. He wasn't part of that going on. But his presence, not a great look. The way to launch your another challenge to Ron Kind in a couple of years.
Jared, quick follow-up. Did Pelosi have any real challengers, or was she basically the only one on the ballot? So you could argue that Kind's choice was either Pelosi or not vote at all.
You could do protest votes. And Pelosi told people privately, according to national media, that her biggest opponent was COVID because of the entire logistics of getting people out there, make sure everybody was present, because they only have an 11-seat majority right now, I believe it is, with two vacancies. You can't afford many defections. You can't afford many people voting for somebody else. I mean, remember, Gwen Moore went to Washington, D.C. 6 days after saying she was COVID-19 positive. Interesting decision that she made, and shows you the importance that Pelosi placed on people being there to vote in person, because they had to be there in person leadership election to keep her as speaker.
Okay, we're almost in overtime, JR, but falling.
Ron Johnson, look, people have talked this week that the wins in Georgia by the two Democratic nominees for these Senate races means Democrats have control of the Senate for the next 2 years because of the tie-breaking vote by Vice President to be Kamala Harris. It also means Ron Johnson no longer has a platform to advance his agenda or his priorities. Because remember, he was term limited already as chair of Homeland Security. But he was in line to get this subcommittee that he could have used to keep investigating election fraud, to keep doing the things he wants to push the message he wants to push. Now that's gone. What does Ron Johnson do for the next 2 years? I mean, he could, one, start a lot of speeches on the floor of the Senate. He can join efforts to push the majority through, and I say majority with, remember, it's 50-50 plus the vice president, push the majority into tough votes, or try and use the levers of power, you know, the levers that the minority has to frustrate the majority. That's not why Ron Johnson went to the U.S. Senate. He wants to get things done. So how is this playing his decision to run for election in 2022? It can't be something that helps the cause. But when I talk to people this week, they don't know what Ron Johnson's going to do. He's a different kind of politician, and they're not. They don't think this is going to be a plus in that decision, but they also don't have a guess what he's going to do because he's just so unique.
Okay. Next week, just quickly, Wisconsin, I know Wisconsin Politics, my friend JR, we're all going to be all over the first online State of the State speech. Okay, in closing, we're going to give a tribute to a pioneering justice, the pioneering feminist, Chief Justice, former Chief Justice Shirley Abramson, died after we taped our last year-end rewinds. So we're going to close with that. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for January 8.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.